Meditation.
Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days.
I mean,
days
I just feel like the waterfall of thoughts. And every now and then, a nice calm.
I can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City.
The Shambhala New York Podcast.
And I'm Dave, your host. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Today, Lodra Winsler joins us for the podcast. You may know him. He is a best-selling author of many books, among them The Buddha Walks Into a Bar, most recently Love Hurts. He is giving a talk, which was recorded at our weekly Dharma gathering a couple of weeks ago, about what the Buddha taught. So maybe you've been getting into meditation. Maybe you've been listening to a lot of these talks. Maybe you have been interested in mindfulness, the mindfulness revolution. But what did the Buddha actually say? What did the Buddha actually teach himself historically? And who was he? So this is a great talk, a very thorough talk. You could even take notes during this talk, or just let the information wash over you like a calming balm. However you take in information, this is a dense talk with a lot of great information about what the Buddha taught. Visit our website, ny.shambhala.org, for all of our upcoming courses and weekend retreats. In particular, the weekend of January 19th, we are offering Shambhala Training Weekend 1. We offer this several times a year. This is the one time of the year, however, when you can take it with both Ethan Nickturn and David Nickturn. Ethan Nickturn is another regular contributor to the podcast. You may know him. He teaches this weekend with his father, David Nickturn, father and son, pair, teachers, leaders of this Shambhala Training Weekend. So it's a great opportunity to dive in, to experience this introductory weekend of meditation with two great teachers and a great staff supporting them. For more information and to register, go to ny.shambhala.org, click the link on the homepage for Shambhala Training Weekend 1. And now, here's Lodra Winsler.
A few months back, I was invited to be on a panel of the future of mindfulness, which I thought was interesting. Mindfulness has been around for thousands of years, but hopefully it will have a future. But I was surprised when I got there because it was me and three other individuals, and they were wonderful individuals. But about 5 minutes into the panel, I sort of had to raise my hand. And they said, yes, Lodro. And I said, so I just want to sort of define our terms here. Because this person is a Vedic meditation practitioner. This person is a yoga teacher. And this person's a shaman. And that's wonderful. But mindfulness actually stems from the Buddhist tradition. So I'm a Buddhist. I was born and raised in this particular tradition of Shambhala. And it is interesting because I feel like this term mindfulness has really grown in popularity without everyone really knowing sort of where it came from. So I wasn't invited back after that. But I do think it is sort of an interesting moment in time because the term has become so popular. There was an article in the New York Times by my friend David Gellis where he was talking about this, and he was at Whole Foods, and he picked up mindful mayo, which is, I don't know if the mayonnaise makes you more mindful or if the mayonnaise is just very present with you while you eat it, but it was mindful mayonnaise. So it is this tipping point of, what does this word even mean? And I use this a little bit during our practice session, that ness is the essence of, and then full, mindful. So it's the essence of us bringing our mind fully to one thing. And the way that this practice originated and has been so popular over the last 2,600 years is particularly around mindfulness of the breath. And I'll come back to this in a little bit. But this is one of many forms of meditation. It's one that I particularly have fallen in love with over the years. And it is, as I mentioned, one of the ones that has been so deeply studied of late, which is why I think we're seeing this rise in popularity, that people are saying, oh, this is a very practical tool for my everyday life. Which is great. It doesn't always, even though it stems from Buddhism, mindfulness in and of itself is not considered a religious thing. Not that Buddhism is necessarily a religious thing, but it is a religious tradition. It has that history. So I wanted to talk a little bit about where this thing came from and talk about what the Buddha actually said. And I have, again, I've been teaching in this particular tradition of Shambhala for 16, 17 years. But I've also studied Zen. I've studied Theravadan practices. And this is sort of a common denominator, some of the things that I'm going to be speaking about tonight, which are known as the Four Noble Truths. And under that fourth one is the Eightfold Path. And under the seventh one of that is the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, that term again. So for some of us, this is like, oh, cool, I get to hear what the Buddha taught. And for some of us who's been coming around for a little bit, this might be a little bit more contextualization of how some of the other things that you've heard. Where does it actually fall in what the Buddha taught? So who is this person, the Buddha? He's sometimes known as the Awakened One. He is often viewed as an example. He's not a god. He wasn't a celestial being sent to save us. He's a person like you and me. And he possesses the same thing that we possess, which is the ability to wake up. It's just that he happened to be really well known for it. So he was born 2,600 years ago, approximately, to Queen Mayadevi and King Suddhodana. And I say king and queen, but it's sort of like he was born as into a royal family in a province of India. And it said, again, of course, this is like lore, we should say, but it was a painless birth. That's what they say. And it said that he had all these signs and marks, like he had long earlobes, and that they knew that this was a special child from day one. And then there was this visiting sage, this old man came to town and looked at the child and said, this child will be one of two things. Either this child would be a great leader of the nation, he would be, essentially become the next king, or this would be a great spiritual leader. And the father, of course, who wanted him to go in the family business, was like, screw the spiritual thing. How can we avoid that? There's no money in that. Same thing that my father told to me when I said I was a religious studies major in college. But in his youth, he was kept incredibly sheltered, but he was still known to be exceptionally compassionate. There's lots of stories from his youth of being really kind. That he was also good at everything. He was that annoying friend that happened to be good at everything right away. It said that he knew 64 languages. He was great at math, at archery. But again, he was very sheltered. He only knew what existed in the palace walls. His father would not let him venture beyond that. And as he grew older, he did not know some of the basic things that we know as we grew up. Around suffering. He married a woman named Yashodhara. He gave birth to a son. And at this point, he started probably to suspect that he was being kept pent in because he named his son Rahula, which can be translated as obstacle, which is not a nice name to give to your kid. I don't recommend it. Probably gives the kid a complex. But he was 29 at this point, and he realized after seeing a little slice of the kingdom that he was going to rule. Just little pockets where he witnessed various forms of suffering. He was so moved, he said, I don't understand this. Can you imagine? He's 29 years old. He's never seen things like sickness and death, old age. He didn't realize that those things would happen. He'd been so incredibly sheltered growing up. So it was shocking to him. And in that last trip that he made up beyond those palace walls, he saw an aesthetic and he thought, oh, I could go live a spiritual life. So this was a late in life teenage rebellion. He was 29 and it said that he used his quote unquote miracle powers, this is how it's often translated, to send the guards to sleep. And he ran off into the night and became a monastic. And he studied with many, many different traditions. It's not that he just went and started doing this one form of meditation. He tried many types. It said everywhere he would go, he would master the practices. He would study with one teacher and a short period of time master whatever that teacher was teaching and say, okay, what else do you have? And the teacher said, nothing. Can I retire? You should teach this. And he would go, no, there's more to it than this. I know there must be more. So he would continue on. And then finally he got a little frustrated and he decided to go and he sat underneath a tree which is today known as the Bodhi tree. Bodhi can be translated as open or awake. And as he pledged to himself, I'm not going to get out from under this tree until I actually wake up. And he took a little bit of rice, which as an ascetic was actually a huge no-no. He had gone from one extreme of luxury to extreme poverty and literally torturing himself in the name of spirituality. And he took a little bit of rice, sort of this initial gesture towards the middle way, that you don't have to do one or the other. You could actually be healthy in this approach. And he sat down and began to do the exact same practice that we just did, the mindfulness of the breath practice, just being present as things come up. And he progressed very quickly, just sitting there under the tree doing this practice. And it said at this pivotal stage, right when he was about to wake up, Mara came. Now, Mara is an interesting thing. Generally, in lore, he's considered the chief of demons. And yet, if we aren't into that sort of idea of like a physical manifestation of obstacles coming up, we probably have already experienced in our own meditation Mara. Self-doubt, self-aggression, whatever it might be, our own obstacles that well up inside of us when we're actually just trying to be with the breath. So if you want to think about it as an external thing or even an internal thing, this sense of obstacle arose. Mara basically looked at him and said, he threw all of these amazing, passionate, wonderful things for the Buddha to try and engage in, and the Buddha was like, no, thank you. I'm going to meditate. And then he sent a bunch of aggressive demons at him. He said, no, thank you. And then finally, the Mara basically looked at him and said, I always think about this almost like one of those people that uses these terms and like are being a little flippant, like chief, boss, you know, something like that. He's like, who do you think you are, boss, that you could actually attain enlightenment? Why you? And it said that in that moment, the Buddha placed his hand down on the ground and the earth literally shuddered in response. And this was his gesture that with the earth as his witness, that he was worthy, as is, to wake up just by virtue of being human. And Mara is said to have fled, and then he continued to meditate into the night and attained enlightenment, nirvana, not just a great grunge band, but also this state of awake. When we talk about enlightenment, nirvana, that's what we're saying. He woke up past his veils of his own confusion and was able to see reality clearly. So that's what he did. And that's why we continue to look to him as an example. Now, in that moment, he thought, what do I do with this? And he thought, I don't know if people will understand how to do what I just did here. But he was moved by his own compassion and got up and went in search of a group of ascetics that he had previously meditated with. And at first, they wanted to sort of shun him because he had taken food, and that's a huge no-no, again, in the ascetic community, in case you want to join such a thing. But they were magnetized to him. They couldn't help themselves. And they came forward and they said, how can we wake up like you woke up? And in that moment, the Buddha could have been extremely dogmatic, been like, we do this thing on this day of the week and we only eat these things, we don't eat those things. But he said to have issued an invitation. Essentially, he said, come and see for yourself. And this is the same invitation that a place like this, the Shambhala Center, continues to extend. 2,600 years later, just can we explore this for ourselves? Can we test the metal of these teachings? Not, again, let it just be dogma, but can we see if this meshes with our own experience, our own life? And if so, then there's real value to it. And if not, then do not just buy into it. And I thought that's so wonderful. That's how we started this whole thing. But he went on to teach these initial group, and they became awake. And he taught what I will go into in just a moment. And he then continued to teach many disciples. It said that his Sangha grew to 1,000, which was back then considered a very big number. Although I saw my niece over Thanksgiving, and she hangs out with certain like trendy crowds, and she has 550,000 Instagram followers. That's a lot of people. And I was like, the Buddha had 1,000 people following. It's just weird times, people. It's very weird times. But he had this massive following. I'm sure he would have had more if he was here today on Instagram. And I mention this because we also think like, oh, who am I? What sort of power do I wield? But we actually, just by virtue of working in a major city or having these connections and being able to travel and having things like social media and email, we actually can reach many people, which is interesting. Anyway, it's tangential. The Buddha taught for many, many years eventually the king, his father, came and fell in love with the whole thing that he was doing, came around. His son came and practiced with him and was said to wake up in a very big way, even his wife. And the Buddha actually was very revolutionary. I should mention that he accepted, at the time, it was very uncommon for women to practice these spiritual arts. And he warmly welcomed them and people from all castes, all traditions. They were all welcome to study and follow these practices and these teachings. But then he hit the age of about 80, it said, and then he let everyone know, I'm going to die soon. Heads up. Get yourself together. Some say that he died of food poisoning, maybe pork, truffle, mushroom. Some said it was just old age. But he lay down on one side and basically said, quote, all composite things are perishable, meaning all things are impermanent. And he said, strive for your own liberation with diligence. So with his last words, he encouraged us to continue to practice in the idea that we too could wake up. But he did leave these teachings for us to do that. So the path that he laid out for us, this Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, Four Foundations of Mindfulness, and many other teachings. But I think this is such a good set of teachings to really introduce so many things that we could get into in the weeks ahead. The Four Noble Truths. Some of you might have even just, I know some of you have heard this regularly here or at other Buddhist centers. You might have even heard it in high school. This is sort of one of those foundational things. The first gets a really bad rap. It's the truth of suffering. Right? I remember when I was in college, I really cherish this, that I was able to study with Jan Willis, who is an incredible Buddhist professor at Wesleyan. She's now retired. And I remember I was pacing back and forth in Buddhism 101. I thought I could get away with just like getting a good grade in Buddhism 101 because I grew up Buddhist. Don't fault me. So her pacing back and forth and saying, dukkha, this ancient word. And she said, life is suffering. Suffering exists. There is suffering. Dissatisfaction exists. There is dissatisfaction. Life is uncertain. There's like a bazillion ways that this thing has been translated in different traditions over time. But the very notion, I mean, the thing that everyone agrees in, is that there is, we can either ignore that suffering exists or we can acknowledge that suffering exists. These are two choices that we have. And the Buddha is said to have taught three different forms of suffering. The first is the suffering of suffering. They couldn't have come up with better names, I guess. So the suffering of suffering is basically the experience of suffering that we normally think of as pain and difficulty. Specifically, he talked about the pains of birth, aging, sometimes it's translated as old age, sickness and death. These things that happen to everyone in this room. I'm sorry, but this is, we know this, right? Like we understand that this is the reality of the situation. The second of the types of suffering was the suffering of change. That when we do have something and we cherish it, we sort of have to realize the fact that this thing's going to change too. The example I often give is that of ice cream. Because I know when I get ice cream, I love ice cream, to be clear. But once I have it, I only have a limited amount of time with it. If I just sit there and just try and stare at it, it will melt and I will not enjoy the ice cream. If I just stare at my phone while I eat the ice cream, I'm not really enjoying the ice cream. So the only thing I have is like 10 minutes of actually enjoying the ice cream. And then hopefully not getting too disappointed when the suffering of change has occurred and it's no longer there. But this is the way things are. So it's not that everything is dark and horrible. There's love. Love is wonderful. For any of us who have been in long-term relationships, we know there's the hot, fiery love, there's the sort of comfortable, mundane love, there's the love that occurs when we miss that person. There's many layers to these things, but it often is changing, even in the context of two people interacting with each other on a regular basis in a committed relationship, right? Like there's just these things change. Whatever it is, it changes. It's not all bad. Sometimes we have a really difficult time with someone and they move in next door to us and we all of a sudden, the change is that we like them. We actually befriend them. That's good change. But there is change. That's the nature of things. Third, all-pervasive suffering. These are really dark titles, I realize. So suffering of suffering, birth, old age, sickness, and death. Suffering of change, things are impermanent. And then suffering, all-pervasive suffering. Which is that we're not this like solid, independent beings. It's not just the us that are changing, that are subject to birth, old age, sickness, and death. It's everyone else here. It's everyone we know. It's all things. All things are, all composite things are perishable. That's what he said. So we're constantly trying to find a sense of solidity. Even though we're constantly changing and evolving and morphing, and everyone else that we're in relationship with is also changing and evolving and morphing. And we're like, solid ground, please. It's hard to find. It's really hard to find. So that's sort of essentially what he's saying. So this is all the first noble truth, however we want to translate the truth of suffering. The second of these four noble truths is the reason why we suffer. The truth of the cause of suffering, which is sometimes translated to dissatisfaction, sometimes it's translated as ignorance. Here we're talking about ignorance to the way things are, reality. I often like the translation of craving. It's the idea that we could be sitting here and we're like in a relatively comfortable position in our career or in our love life, and we're like, but what's the next thing? Right? What's the next thing ahead? When I was a kid, my mother, we celebrated Christmas for some reason, even though we were Buddhist, and she said, you know, what happens when you get the presents on Christmas? I say, I want something else. She goes, so this is this thing, right? We see this. I've seen this with my nephew. You know, he gets the thing that he wanted, and he's like, now what's the other thing I want now? And we're just constantly craving something else. If we're sitting here and we're perfectly content, we are craving to be in front of Netflix. We're sitting in front of Netflix, we're feeling, oh, I should go see people. We're craving to be in front of, with other people. We're always craving something other than what's going on right now. It's very rare, at least I should say, that we just relax into things as they are. So we're looking elsewhere, outside of ourselves, for satisfaction, thinking whatever that thing out there is going to be, whether it's the new car, the new job, the new relationship, then we'll be happy. And more often than not, we'll end up pretty disappointed if we base our life around that. Third noble truth, known in my head at least as the good news truth, the cessation of suffering. There can be an end to suffering. That's what all she wrote. Fourth noble truth, which is the how. How do we actually do this? The truth of the path, the idea that we would actually apply mindfulness and compassion to all of our activities by training in meditation and bringing this into our daily life. So sometimes this is thought of as almost like we are going to the doctor. And the first noble truth is the diagnosis. The doctor says, you have this disease. It's called suffering. And then the second noble truth is the cause of the disease. How did you get it? Craving, discontentment, dissatisfaction. The third noble truth is the prognosis. Can the patient heal? And the good news is yes, we can. And then the fourth noble truth is the cure, the path to recovery, which is the path of meditation in everyday life. So what is this path? The path, sometimes known as the Eightfold Path, is a series of me using the word right a lot, which is, I don't necessarily love, it's how it's often translated, like right view, right intention, etc. My friends in the Theravada world often use the word wise, which I actually might prefer. I'll say both. Fun fact about this, which may interest you or bore you. The way I always remember these is I think of like a really awesome drag queen in Vegas named Vivian. And Vivian is this like sexy adult lounge singer. And before Vivian goes on, just going to town on eating moist cupcakes. So Vivian is a sexy adult lounge singer eating moist cupcakes, which translates to right view, right intention, right action, right livelihood, right speech. Sorry, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. This is how my mind works. Thanks for coming along for the ride. So right view, Vivian. The right view is the view that we actually are in tune with reality. The view that, yes, there is suffering. There's all of the Four Noble Truths, the teachings that actually point out reality. The view that we can actually turn our mind to that as opposed to turning our mind to what is coming out next on Netflix, right? That we're actually turning our mind in that direction. Right intention. The intention here is that we are actually trying to work with our mind and have a different relationship than what we might normally have when it comes to looking at our suffering. Instead of ignoring it, we're actually trying to acknowledge it. We're willing to lean in and see what sort of suffering exists on our level, in our interpersonal relationships, and even in society around us. That we're willing to actually rouse ourselves and be of benefit to ourselves and others. So that's the intention that the Buddha talked about, the wise intention, or right intention. And the next one would be right speech, sometimes known as wise speech. This is a really interesting one. It's traditionally thought of that we wouldn't lie, that we wouldn't use our speech to gossip, that we wouldn't slander other people, speak negatively about them, that we wouldn't use it in a way that divides people from one another, like, you know, that person over there said this about you. We wouldn't do that. It's also said that we shouldn't use harsh and abusive speech. We shouldn't call people names, tell them to F off. And that we shouldn't even do idle speech, which is so in the weeds of it all. But like, if you're on an elevator and you just sort of say something to fill the space because you feel a little uncomfortable with space, that's idle speech. So there's lots of different ways to look at this. But it's essentially saying that our words can create happiness or suffering, and we would like to actually use this. The wise way to use our speech is to engage people from the point of view of trying to bring about a sense of contentment and meaning, as opposed to trying to put them down. My teacher and the head of the Shambhala lineage, who's directly above my head here, Sakyong Mipam Rinpoche, just wrote a beautiful book. I had the great honor of traveling with him on his book tour and teaching on this topic. It's called The Lost Art of Good Conversation. How interesting that it's 2017 and we actually need the head of a Buddhist lineage to say, here's how you have a conversation, people. But it is. It feels very real right now that we're not always seeing other people or even using our own speech in ways that are helpful. Often people are using it in ways that sort of strike others down. And he was saying, actually, I remember, in the light of the Buddha, I should mention that this was an oral tradition for hundreds of years before anyone ever sat down and started to write this stuff out. And in order for that to happen, it was basically passed down through conversation where someone would say, so here's what I heard, that person heard what the Buddha said. So all of the sutras, the words of the Buddha, always start because it's someone who says, thus have I heard, and then they continue on. At no point in the entirety of the Buddhist canon do any of these things start with, thus I did not listen. So even part of the thing I learned while I was traveling with the Sakyong on this tour is even the act of listening as a way to actually hone wise speech or right speech is very powerful. So where are we with Vivian? Right action or wise action. This is generally doing things that are helpful and not harmful. Sometimes people translate these things as trying to refrain from destroying life, stealing, sexual acts that are harmful to ourselves or other person. Basically, all of the things that, if you've ever woken up the next morning and be like, oh, I shouldn't have done that, that's basically what the Buddha's talking about, that we would want to refrain from those things. So right action, when we get off the cushion and engage our world, are we engaging in activities that we feel are helpful and meaningful or that actually are tearing things down a bit? View, intention, speech, action, and now we're in livelihood. People love this one, right? Right livelihood or wise livelihood. What does that mean? It is said to be livelihood that is of benefit to others, or at least, again, doesn't cause harm. Now, I'll go through the very traditional list, and then I'll critique it. It's said that you can't deal, in order to have right livelihood, you can't deal in living beings, which includes things like prostitution, slavery, or raising animals for slaughter. These are examples that were often given. You can't make money selling weapons or selling poison or selling intoxicants or selling meat. This is a very traditional list, which means that if we have anyone in the room who's an exterminator, they're like, oh, but there's poison. I eat poison, right? Or if you are a bartender, you're like, oh, shoot, am I not doing right livelihood? Or if you are a butcher, or even if, you know, my poor friends who work at the deli on my corner, if they're selling sandwiches, would that all of a sudden be like, oh, you're dealing in meats, right? Like, it's not, These things, by the way, all have been interpreted extremely tightly and extremely loosely. And if we go back to the initial thing before the Buddha even mentioned these, it's more interesting for us to actually come and see for ourselves what these things mean than to necessarily get dogmatic. So what does right livelihood mean for us? When Sakyong Mipam Rinpoche was asked to write about this, he had this line in his book, Ruling Your World, where he said, what makes for our livelihood, I'm sorry, paraphrasing here, good or bad, he said, quote, is not our vocation but our view. I.e., it's not that we are, you know, if we do this one job, we're clear, and what, if we do this other job, we are horrible. It's like, what view do we have when we engage our work? Do we actually, whatever our work is, even if we think it doesn't help anyone, or even if we think it's, we're sort of on the fence about, could we engage our vocation with the view that we could actually be of benefit to others? It's a very interesting question for us to just hold. What would that look like? The Dalai Lama once said, our whole purpose in this life is to help others, and if you can't help them, at least don't hurt them. And I think that's sort of what the last several of these actually mean. Whether it's our speech or our actions or our livelihood, could we actually come at it from the view of helping others? And if we can't help them, could we at least not harm them? Could we not create more harm in the world? Okay, home stretch. Right effort. This is where Vivian's eating moist cupcakes. Effort, mindfulness, concentration. Right effort, meaning that we would actually endeavor to give rise to skillful thoughts and deeds, meaning that we would also endeavor and exert ourselves in the effort of letting go of some of our negative patterns, some of the things that actually are habitually holding us back from engaging in all these other pieces of our work. Right mindfulness, and I'm going to come back to this in just one moment, because the Buddha then taught a whole sutra just on this called the Satipatthana Sutra, which is known as the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And then the more we develop right mindfulness, it turns into right concentration, deep concentration in our meditation, that we're actually living our life through the lens of actually this deep presence and ability to be there, hold space, and embody these teachings. So these four foundations of mindfulness, falling under the heading of our right mindfulness or wise mindfulness, they are the mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feeling, come back to how that's translated, mindfulness of mind, and mindfulness of dharmas. And I'll say what dharmas is in a moment because there's so many translations. Mindfulness of the body. So there are a few ways that the Buddha taught about this in the Satipatthana Sutra. One is the mindfulness of our breathing, that we could focus on the sensation of the breath. So I want to come full circle for a moment, that when people are like, mindfulness is a really cool thing, let's have a future of mindfulness practice, our panel, what we're essentially saying is, cool, so you know that this is actually the first of the four foundations of mindfulness, which is one aspect of the right mindfulness, which is one of the eightfold noble path, which is the fourth of the four noble truths. So now we know where this is actually from. Cool? It's a long-winded way to get there, but that's where it is. The Buddha also talked about, and I think this is fascinating. So right alongside that, he says, and there's four postures, by the way. There's, you could do walking, you could do standing, you could do sitting, you could do laying down. We don't really talk about laying down meditation much. We don't even talk about standing meditation much. Here in this particular tradition, there's a heavy emphasis on walking and sitting meditation. But he says the exercise here is simply to be aware at all times of the disposition of the body, that we could actually become very mindful of the body itself. And then there's this really morbid part where it's like the Buddha talks about like this much, just a little bit about mindfulness of the breath, and then like half of this thing, it gets really morbid really quickly into what is commonly known as the cemetery contemplations, where it's like if we're being mindful of the body, we should actually get into seeing the body as a collection of parts, the hair of the head, the hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin, sinews, bones, marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, membranes, spleen, lungs, bowels, intestines, gorge, whatever that is, dung, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, snot, spittle, oil of the joints, whatever that is, urine, and the brain is sometimes added as well. And we're like, let's just be mindful of the breath, right? But he goes on. He's like, oh, and by the way, you know, it's a reflection of these material elements, that the body's made up of earth, water, air, fire, and that we should actually contemplate our own mortality, that we should actually contemplate the charnel grounds, that the body will at some point fester, that our corpse will be devoured by birds. We could contemplate what our skeleton held together by tendons, our skeleton with some flesh and blood remaining, just bones. Like, it goes on and on, but we're like, mindfulness of the breath is really cool. I'm going to hang out there. I just think this is fascinating, because there is a lot that has been taught around this. And of course, we don't just like think about the body as this composite of parts and our own mortality to scare ourselves, but to actually realize the preciousness of our own human life. That we actually would then be more interested in being present if we realize, if we didn't actually have sort of a vivid understanding that we only have so much time here. So that's the first of the four foundations of mindfulness, mindfulness of the body. And the next one is known as vedana. It's often translated as feeling, sometimes as feeling tone. The idea that we could actually be mindful of the various feelings that emerge. Often that is, I like this thing, I don't like this thing, I ignore this thing. But actually starting to notice that, both on the meditation seat and in our day-to-day life, that we have certain aversions to some things, certain passions and attachments to other things, and just some things we're just going to blatantly try and ignore or block out. Could we become more present, more mindful to those things? The third of these four foundations of mindfulness is often known as mindfulness of the mind or our state of consciousness. That we could actually be like, who's even talking in my own head? When I'm meditating, like, what's that voice? Can we actually just ask, like, what is that? That voice that's telling me I'm not good enough, or that voice that's telling me that I've got work on Monday, or whatever it is. What is that? There is a 19th century Zen master and poet named Ryokan, who was this wandering monk, and he expressed it very simply, quote, know your mind just as it is, unquote. That's it. Just know your mind just as it is, which means that we're not judging the mind. It's just actually getting to know it extremely well. The Sakyong's first book, I'm on all of his books today for some reason, was Turning the Mind into an Ally, which is such a beautiful introduction to meditation. It's a great book, but I love that because it's such an apt title that we're not beating the mind into submission. It's turning the mind into an ally, that this practice is essentially befriending ourselves. So this is sort of like tuning in, becoming mindful of the background of our mind, the basic level of tone, of conscious awareness that's present. Often, we just sort of chase our thoughts down rabbit holes, and here we're sort of turning this around, almost putting a mirror up to it. Traditional analogy here is that when we throw a stick for a dog, the dog chases the stick. We throw a stick for a lion, the lion looks around and goes, who threw that stick? So we're looking around and saying, where did the thoughts even come from? That's what we're talking about with mindfulness of the mind. And then the last one is mindfulness of dharmas. Dharmas here is all phenomena. Sometimes it's known as mental formations. And this is where it gets interesting for people who have been around the block here at Shambhala for a little bit, because this is us becoming mindful of all the different parts of reality, such as the five what are known as hindrances, the mental states that actually lead us astray, like desire, anger, sloth, worry, skeptical doubt. Not that we shouldn't be skeptical, but that we would continuously doubt ourselves. So the Buddha went on to say, you know, there's ways that we can work with this. If we actually are feeling a lot of sense desire, we could come into the body. We could actually contemplate the 32 parts of the body or even the cemetery contemplations I mentioned earlier. If we're feeling a lot of anger, he taught this whole sutta known as the Metta Sutra, which is loving kindness practice, which is a beautiful practice to do. He said if we experience a lot of sloth, that we could even change our posture and even actually adjust our relationship to the light if it's too dark. He said if we are lost in worry, that we could come into mindfulness of breathing. And he said if we are lost in doubt, that we could increase our study and ask questions so that we could understand more. Also under the mindfulness of all phenomena or dharmas, there's the five aggregates, sometimes known as the five skandhas, if people give them talks on five skandhas here, which are form, the body, feeling, mindfulness of the feelings, our sense perceptions, our mental formations, and our consciousness. It's also under here what are known as the six doors of consciousness, our eye, our ear, our nose, our tongue, our body, our mind, the ways that we perceive the world. Seven factors of enlightenment. And then it comes back to the Four Noble Truths and Eightfold Path. It's the last thing that we could actually be mindful of, present to. The Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path. So we have come, for anyone who's still with me, all the way back to Do. Right? So we've gone through Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, Four Foundations of Mindfulness, all the way back to this last aspect, the fifth aspect of all phenomena, which is becoming mindful of the Four Noble Truths and Eightfold Path. Why does any of this matter? Well, it's not just the Buddha who is able to wake up in a very big way. It's also us. We have the same seed, the same potential for enlightenment. And even though we don't have him here as a guide, we have many wonderful other teachers who have worked with the teachings that he has left, what is known as the Dharma, the teachings, such as the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and these ways of working with the foundations of mindfulness. We could spend a whole life just on that, but in certain schools, you'll notice that there is emphasis on some other aspects of this. People tease out, for example, the five skandhas, and there's much more in terms of looking at the way that we consider the solid sense of self or emptiness of others. I mentioned the loving-kindness practice, practices that we could do in the other teachings of the Buddha that actually allow us to become more connected to others and actually start to work through some of that mindfulness of Vedana, feeling that we could actually open our heart to people we like, don't know, and dislike. So there's so much richness that I wasn't able to even tap into tonight because we only have so much time. But the idea is that ultimately, at the core of it, we could become familiar with our suffering. And the more we actually become familiar with the ways that we get stuck, the ways that we are not so mindful, the more we actually see our way through to becoming more awake. So we could either nail this completely, Eightfold Path, great, got it all right, or we do this whole trial by error thing, which after a lifetime of this, it's not so bad. That we would actually continue to test the mettle of his teachings and say, does this mesh with my experience? Sometimes we are able to actually rise to the occasion and be present and show up in ways that we feel are meaningful. Some ways we fall down and we say, okay, I can learn from this. And the more we do that work on both sides, the more we actually wake up. So how do we tackle the suffering? We actually look directly at it. We actually explore why we don't experience our awakened mind all the time. And the more we explore this, the more we are actually able to live a life of meaning, a life that actually feels that we're not held by our suffering. In fact, last Sakyong quote, I promise, he once said, every moment has its energy, and either it can ride us or we can ride it. And the reason that we study these teachings today, the reason that we could meditate, is so that we do not get ridden by our suffering, by our anxiety, by our worry, by our doubt, by our anger, whatever it might be. That we could actually, in that moment, tune in, become a little bit more present to what it is, the very nature of it, and ride the energy of that moment and show up in ways that we think are helpful to ourselves and to others, and ideally, at the very least, don't cause harm. I've gone on long enough. I would very much like to hear what is on your mind, what questions might be coming.
I have a question regarding Buddha's predecessors, the three predecessors. I know he was the fourth Buddha, so I was wondering, did he have a mention or teach about his three predecessors before him?
Yeah, so did the Buddha have a teacher?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the Buddha had many teachers. I don't think the Buddha, for example, invented mindfulness. I should be very clear about that. I think he really did a good job of explaining it, and he preserved those teachings in a way that were really helpful to many people. But he learned that, right? He learned many forms of meditation. If you go to a Vedic meditation course, they're going to tell you, oh, yeah, the Buddha, he was one of ours, which I think is very funny. Because I'm sure there is some truth to it, that the Buddha studied that. He studied many forms of different types of meditation. And every time he would say, okay, I get this. This is cool, but it's not for me. And I think there's something for us to learn from that. That he didn't just say, okay, I'm buckling down and this is the thing and I'm disloyal if I go and I study something else. It's like, oh, I can actually explore and see again which of these teachings actually mesh with my experience, which feel most relevant to my day-to-day being. And essentially for him, that turned into just being present. being present with the breath, being present with what was going on in his mind, and actually seeing his way through his own confusion using this very simple tool. Yeah, thank you for that. Other questions?
I feel a little overwhelmed.
Totally understandable, yes.
And I was just wondering if, you know, there were two or three points you would want us to take away from this, what they would be.
Yeah. So, one, yes, there is suffering, and I'm sorry. And that suffering is everything from getting a hangnail to having a life-threatening illness to losing your job to divorcing from that person who we thought we were spending our life with. There's many forms of suffering in between. But, two, we actually, even though pain and difficulty arises, don't have to perpetuate our own suffering. We don't have to go down every single rabbit hole that comes up in our meditation or our post-meditation experience. That we could actually start to use these practices to unweave some of the knots that have been there for decades for many of us, so that we don't have to suffer so much. We don't perpetuate our own suffering so much. Three, the more we do this, the more aware we are of our own suffering, the more we start to see it in others, and the more we actually might be motivated to go out and try and help this world. So yes, there's our suffering, but as I mentioned before, there's our interpersonal suffering, suffering within the relationships of our life, and societal suffering. And the world could use a lot of help right now. It absolutely could. So in some sense, we come to something like this and we say, I just want to have less stress. When you talked about that, that sounds really nice. And that's fine. That's totally cool. That could be where we start. But don't be surprised and don't come yell at me if a couple months from now of meditating regularly, you're a little bit more compassionate too. And like you're actually connecting more with others, because that's just going to happen. I'm sorry. So I think that these practices can have vast ramifications, but it starts with actually knowing what we're even talking about. So I'm doing something a little bit different than what we might traditionally do on a weekly Dharma gathering, and you're right, it's an incredibly long download. But I wanted us to have context for all these other things that we're studying around mindfulness of emotions or working with anger or whatever else. This is all came from this root source, and it all sort of fits together quite nicely in terms of looking at suffering, how to overcome suffering, and how to be of help. Those three. Thank you for that.
Thank you. I really appreciated your talk. And I was envisioning a chart, you know, with the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, blah, 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 and kind of seeing how it's all connected and wondering if there actually is such a chart and where I might find it.
Yes, there are many such things. In fact, even if you went on this handy thing called Google, you would find it. If you typed in like Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, you'd get unlimited amount of resources. Not all of them are going to be good, but you'll see a lot of images and charts. I like Reginald Ray wrote a book called, wrote two big ones. Yep, this one, I want to say, it's Indestructible Truth. And he lays out the different turnings of the wheel of Dharma, the different big views that the Buddha made, and then he sort of breaks out some of these teachings. And I think that's actually a super helpful tool. For those who are feeling overwhelmed, A, completely get it. B, I could have gone a lot longer, I'm so sorry. But like, this is the first turning of the wheel of Dharma. There's also a second and a third. Tune in next week. No, I'm kidding. I'm not going to keep going in this. But I think it's really interesting. That's a great book for it. Yeah.
Reginald Ray.
Indestructible Truth.
Okay.
And if you're interested in these types of topics, though, I still think Stephen Batchelor's Buddhism Without Beliefs is really helpful. And Walpula Rahula's What the Buddha Taught. Those are both really good, just fundamental. I mean, last one was written in 1959. It's still good. Yeah.
I got one more question. So they say you should do meditations on emptiness. I know I heard that before. So they say all there is really emptiness in the mind. So which one came first, mind or emptiness? Are they one and the same? Are they like yin and yang or female, male? What is it?
Correct. If we were at a Zen center, it'd just be like, yes, and then we'd move on. But this is why people sometimes get frustrated with Zen people. When I was a kid, I asked, like, do the Buddhists have a good creation story? I mean, you know what my mom said? She said, there was wakefulness, and then it second-guessed itself. And I think that's sort of it. Like, there is, we similarly have this, like, sense of vast ability to wake up. And for many of us, we might even get little glimmers of that as we meditate. That moment that we're actually able to relax into the breath, we're like, oh, is this what they're talking about? And then we're like, oh, now I'm second-guessing myself, and now I'm going, and it, we travel 10 steps down that rabbit hole of thought. But for those moments that we glimpse it, we're like, oh, maybe there is some seed of awakening here. And it's always there, and I just have to discover it, which is good news. We don't have to go get it at, like, the drugstore. We can actually, we already have it. That said, the question is around emptiness. Now, emptiness is a very complex topic. And he said, you know, is the emptiness of mind? Is mind empty? There's one of the sutras, the teachings of the Buddha, is known as the Prajnaparamita Sutra. It's also sometimes translated as the Heart Sutra. In this particular place, we sometimes chant that thing. And there's this beautiful line in it where these two principal students of the Buddha are having this debate, and one of them says, form is emptiness, emptiness also is form. What does this mean? You brought this on yourself. Okay. What am I holding? A glass of water. Okay. That's interesting that you perceive it like that, because I was going to take one of those flowers, put it in here, in which case you would call it a vase. Cool. So which one is it?
Both.
Okay. If I pour this out and put this on my head, it's a hat now. Is it both or is it neither at this point? Yeah. Okay. So this is the problem. This is why we're here and not at the Zen Center. I love the Zen Center. They're wonderful people. Something like this, we're communally just agreeing that this is a glass of water, and that's why we perceive it as such. In essence, it is a coming together. This glass was made maybe in a factory in China. It came together. It's not that it just independently exists. It's just, it has this whole lifespan. There are people who delivered it here. There are people who have been drinking out of this for years. It came together from composite forms. And like the Buddha said way back on my, when he was dying, he said, all composite forms are perishable. So we also know that this can break and that this isn't always going to be here. So even though we perceive it as one thing, a glass of water, it could be many things, it could be nothing. So it isn't as solid and real as we suspect. Now, let me switch this around. And I said, I got annoyed earlier. What did my frustration look like? You wouldn't be like, I don't know, purple? Like, we don't, it's even harder with things that we don't necessarily perceive. But when I feel frustrated, I feel frustrated. Screw you for telling me not to feel frustrated, right? So these things come up, but they're not as solid and real and existent and forever as we might always perceive them. That's what we mean when we say that form is emptiness. And at the same time, I'm able to get refreshing water from this. So emptiness is also form. It's also actually serving a purpose here. Which is why when people like go down the road of emptiness, they're like, oh, it's all nihilistic. No, it's not. It's if you just are like, everything is empty, you will end up on the streets because you're not going to work and paying rent. Like, that's not going to be beneficial. It's not actually going to be helpful for yourself or for others. So we do have to look at the relative notion of the way things are, as well as that sort of absolute notion of things are not as solid and real as we always think they are. We have to balance both. You asked for it. Any other questions before we have to break? Over here, yeah.
That was really wonderful and really stimulating and provocative and informative. And I'm really grateful to be diving into these topics during just the constant news storm that we're in. And I want to read a lot of the books that you mentioned. I wanted to, pause a little bit and unpack the initial moment you described of being on this panel. Because I imagine that many of us, I know I am often in situations where I'm in kind of on that panel and but not elevated on a stage among people that think they're doing, propagating mindfulness practices, participating in mindfulness practices. They just read something on a blog, they're doing this. They think that they believe in what they're doing. And there's a lot of research coming out, and it's in really, there's good intention there, right? When you were talking about right speech, I was hoping you could just bring me into the moment of when you decided to speak up on that panel and why you decided to share this tonight. Because well, I was thinking about when you were describing, you know, the Buddha did not make up mindfulness. He could have been hanging out with people on a panel and people could have thought they were talking about mindfulness and he was like, no, it's my thing. So why do you now, is it right speech and is it important to make this distinction?
Yeah. So this is an excellent question. And there's twofold. One is, it's important for us not to just conflate words and let them be random words, right? Like mindfulness means something. And it's also being bandied around like it doesn't mean anything. If we're calling ourselves, if we're calling our mayonnaise mindful, we're losing the point of the word, right? If it would be like, oh gosh, it's a horrible example considering maybe someone will listen to this years from now when it's a different president. But if I called this president clock, this isn't the president. It's a clock, right? It's just different. That's it. It's taking the word president and making it mean something else, which it currently does. And then there's the other aspect, which is these people have their own rich traditions. And to lump them under my thing of mindfulness does them a disadvantage. The Vedic tradition predated the time of the Buddha. My business partner is a Vedic meditation practitioner. There's a real rich history to that. And to say that you're a mindfulness person actually negates that. So I think it's important for us to simultaneously respect the cultures and the traditions from which these things come from, and also to sort of say what the practices mean. Because if we all think meditation is just one thing, mindfulness, then we're actually missing some of the richness of meditation, such as loving kindness practice, which is not a mindfulness practice. It's a very different type of practice. It's contemplative in nature. So there's much more to it. And it's not an ownership so much as a, can we clarify, and particularly since there, you know, in cases like that, there are more than 1,000 people actually listening, say, wait, let's be clear about what these things are so that we don't actually put out fake news, right? We actually talk about reality because that's what the Buddha wanted us to talk about, reality as it is. Yeah, that's a great question.
I know I already asked a question, but when you were talking about right speech and right action and right all that, I was feeling tremendously guilty.
This is the confessional part of the evening. We all go and say the time we lied. It was like, idle speech.
It was like I wanted to say to everybody here, how many of you are doing right speech and right action and, you know, and what does it consist of? And so anyway, could you address that guilt thing?
Yes. It's funny, before my parents became Buddhist, they were Jewish, and some sort of translation happened where I inherited Buddhist guilt, which is like the guilt that you feel when you don't meditate regularly, stuff like that, or you fall down on the job of something like right speech, which happens. It happens even though I've been meditating for a long time and teaching for a long time, that sometimes you say something. And I actually love this particular aspect in some of the Theravada traditions. At the end of teaching, they will close by saying, and if I have hurt any of you, knowingly or unknowingly, I ask for your forgiveness. What an interesting way to end a set of teachings. And I feel this right now. Like if I have confused you or hurt you or said something that was insensitive, I sincerely ask for your forgiveness and your patience with me. Because I am just a person who doesn't always live from the view of right speech or right action or whatever it might be. And I think in this particular tradition, there's a heavy emphasis on just understanding our own humanity. That if something goes wrong, it doesn't mean we're bad. In fact, we have this sort of core of our own basic goodness, we would say here. That inherently we are good, whole, complete as is. When I told the story of the Buddha and Mara is coming at him, he places his hand down and he says, I'm worthy. It's essentially a gesture of worthiness. I can be awake because I'm human. And the other side of being human is that sometimes we mess up. And that is part of it. It's just, when I said before, we either learn and we perfectly embody these things, or we make mistakes and we learn from that. And I think in my own experience, I'll just speak for me, there's something very rich about that, of having that moment where we fall down on the job, so to speak, around right speech, and saying, oh, I don't want to do that again. Yeah, I should be more sensitive to that particular thing. And then ideally we don't repeat it. Sometimes we do, and then we learn again. So I don't think we should feel guilty if we're not living in full line with the idea of the Eightfold Path or anything like that. Oh, I've got to quit my job tomorrow. Please don't quit your job tomorrow. It's more interesting for us to sort of struggle with these things and say, okay, here's where I am in my path. What do any of these things actually mean to me today? Not a lofty goal for me to hit. What does it mean for me today? And you might find that one aspect of this, maybe it's one of the four foundations of mindfulness, maybe it's one aspect of the Eightfold Path, that's the thing you're like, I want to look at the livelihood thing more. I want to look at right action. Whatever it is, great, my job is done. Because it's more about us becoming inquisitive about our own experience and our own life than us necessarily trying to get everything right. It's more human than that. So with that said, I am so deeply grateful that you would let me come and sit here in front of you and try to extrapolate on these essential teachings. I hope that they are helpful in some way, even just some small nugget. And again, if you are completely overwhelmed and hate this, I'm sure next week it'll be like working with anger or something very juicy, but not as academic as what I just did, and that's awesome. And next time I will come back and do like heartbreak or something juicy like that.
Phew. Told you. This was a humdinger of a talk, as they used to say. I'm listening to this biography of Harry Truman, so I'm using words like humdinger. Visit our website, nmy.shambhala.org, for all of our upcoming courses and weekend retreats. Again, Shambhala Training Weekend 1 with David Nickturn and Ethan Nickturn is happening the weekend of January 19th. Lots of other great classes and weekend retreats happening starting in the new year. Email us at podcast@shambhalanyc.org, your questions, comments, suggestions. If you happen to live in a different city, there's probably a Shambhala Meditation Center near you. Look us up. But if you are in the New York City area, come say hi. Our weekly Dharma gathering is every Tuesday night at 7 o'clock. Thanks for listening. Later.